Or another title is Does Inflation Actually Work? And we'll see soon enough what that's about. So here's the introduction. Here are things everybody knows about cosmic inflation. It solves cosmological puzzles, makes a bunch of predictions, it's faced the chance to be falsified, and it's emerged very successful. And we also know it could use a more fundamental formulation. What is the inflaton? How well does inflation compete with other paths to the universe we see? And a bunch of other things. The point of this talk is specifically to look into this item number 2, and I was stimulated to do that by this work of Dyson et al, where I think is really a first ever attempt to formulate this question in a systematic way where you could have quantitative answers. And so that's sort of the starting point of this talk. And the why it's an interesting starting point is they actually came to the conclusion that inflation failed in an absolutely stunning way. And that, in fact, even the Big Bang fails to work properly in their formulation. So here's, I think, the first, you know, everyone kind of knows that inflation seems to make sense and give the right way to create the universe, but the first time it's achieved this level of being quantified, it didn't work at all. And so I find that interesting. And the failure modes, by the way, are, you know, even though most people had a good, happy feeling about inflation all along, there were people who were raising objections along the way and who might be reading this paper and saying, I told you so. So Penrose and Wald and Unruh. And actually, I think a lot of these objections go back to stuff Boltzmann worried about before, when he wasn't really trying to do cosmology in the way we think of it today. And if you're interested in that connection, I've written a little bit about that, but I'm not going to dwell on that in this talk. So in this talk, what I'd like to do is investigate what is really at the root of these failures in this specific case, and also then get into the question of, are these failures fundamental to all formulations of cosmology? Are they tightly linked with specific assumptions made in that paper? And so the reason I'm particularly excited to be giving this talk, of course, it's always fun to talk about stuff you've been thinking about, but I also think there's actually concrete questions, possibly even tractable questions that come out of this that are very that are very connected with the expertise here in this room. So I'm hoping this is going to be a really fun week to talk with people about some of these things and maybe learn something. So that's the introduction. So I'm not going to assume people know a lot about the basic assumptions and frameworks, so I'm going to set that up in the next part of the talk and then remind people sort of in this context what inflation is supposed to do, and then show you how it doesn't do it, and then start talking about generalizing, you know, trying to understand how big the problems are and what concrete questions might come out of it. So the basic framework is that we think about the universe spending most of its time sitting in equilibrium, in some kind of equilibrium. And the equilibrium state in this case is defined by a causal patch of de Sitter space with a very small lambda, possibly a lambda that's accelerating the universe today. Although that's sort of, it shouldn't be larger than that, but it could be smaller. It could be sort of just a parameter that sort of controls the calculation, and you could have quintessence or something else driving the acceleration today. So that's not an important issue at this point anyway. And so cosmology in this picture is generated by looking at fluctuations. So here's this equilibrium state, and it looks nothing like Big Bang cosmology or anything like it. But cosmology happens when this equilibrium state has some rare fluctuation and produces a Big Bang or whatever. And this is a way to systematically analyze the different paths to the universe we observe. And there's specific quantitative ways that you can evaluate the probabilities of different things happening. Rob?
What do you mean exactly by thermal equilibrium? If you consider space, all matter is exponentially diluted.
No, but the quantum fluctuations are thermal. So I'm talking about I'm talking about the quantum de Sitter space. That's
maybe in other words, the question which he asked is valid, because if you study a quantum fluctuation in de Sitter space, the way how we did it when we studied density perturbations in the equation of the universe, you quantize everything in a conformally flat space, and there is no temperature there. The temperature appears exactly when you go into this study of quantum.
That's right. Right, so that's one of the assumptions. So, right, so that's part of the program that's being followed here, is to take the causal patch very seriously and think about a thermal horizon. There's a whole package of ideas that are in use here. That's absolutely right. And maybe there's other. So certainly part of the, and in fact you'll see just how seriously those ideas come into play. And it's certainly one of the points of this talk would be that we really should scrutinize exactly, you know, which of these ideas we believe and so on. So yeah, well, that'll definitely be a recurring theme. And speaking of recurrences, the recurrence times or probabilities can be given by just comparing. So the time between fluctuations of a particular sort is equal to the recurrence time of the whole system, which you assume is well defined with a finite total number of states and so on. You look at the number of microstates that are consistent with a particular type of fluctuation. You take the ratio with the total number of states, which you can express in terms of an entropy, and you can get the recurrence time of a given type of fluctuation as compared with the recurrence time of the whole system. Or you can express that in terms of the probability of finding a particular fluctuation, which is basically the ratios, sort of proportional to the number of states, number of microstates consistent with that type of fluctuation. Is the recurrence time of the whole system. So the system is a finite system. Sorry? So it's right, it's the right. So the, right, the total number of states in the system is given by the entropy, the Sitter entropy of that. Of the e to the Sitter entropy of that system is the.
What I'm confused about is that if you take the most generic state, which is empty de Sitter space,
right.
It would seem that the time for that non-fluctuation to happen should be very small. But in that formula, it's still equal to the recurrence time. Because the fraction on the right-hand side is 1, and then there's still the TR.
So the number of states consistent with equilibrium is equal to the number of total states to some approximation. So this turns out to be 1. Oh, so the recurrence.
It seems to me like you're dividing twice by e to the area.
Well, I think this is the right formula. Let's go, I'm going to go to an example in a minute, and we can see how that works out. So just explaining more. I think, you know, maybe people, this is overkill to explain everything, but I've defined it, written out the definitions of all these things: recurrence times, number of microstates, all the things I've already said in words. So I think I'll move on and note that this is assuming ergodic behavior, and if you ask what I mean by ergodic behavior, it means that all this stuff is true. It's basically assuming that counting states is equivalent to counting the time it takes to go sort of between fluctuations, and so there's a at least a natural framework to do these calculations, even if you you know, of course you might ask questions about how rigorous and how much you want to believe it, but there's certainly a framework to start with, which I find exciting, because these are questions that have hung with us for a while, and it's nice to have something concrete to actually deal with them. So an illustration, box of gas, of course, that's what physicists always talk about when they talk about statistical systems to start with. So have a box of gas and imagine a weird fluctuation that carves out a corner of that box, and all the gas in that corner fluctuates up into the corner and then fluctuates out again. I've just labeled it here, so the fraction of the volume that participates in this fluctuation is given by F, and the further size reduction is given by a factor G here. And then I can calculate, and I'm assuming, for example, this is a relativistic gas, so I know some formulas to use. I can write down a formula for the entropy density, and I can conserve energy to figure out what the temperature is in this little patch and get a formula for the entropy. So this is the entropy of the fluctuation, which includes the entire state. So basically this is the equilibrium entropy, and then it's reduced by this factor, and then enhanced, then there's a slight enhancement because there's not zero entropy here, there's a little bit of entropy in that box. And so when you evaluate, for example, the probability of this fluctuation, you plug into these formulas and you find that the probability of this particular fluctuation is given by this expression. I have to say, this looks like it's greater than one, doesn't it? I think I must have left off a factor. These are. I think I just dropped a sign. Actually, this sign is missing down here. Sorry about that. One interesting point is that what matters most in evaluating the probability of this fluctuation, if this little thing is small, is mainly that you've taken a section of the gas and said it could not, you've taken it out of equilibrium, and so that's cost you. So instead of having this region nicely situated in equilibrium, you've removed it from equilibrium, and the amount you've removed from equilibrium is the dominant effect in this evaluating the probability, and what exactly is going on up here, as long as it's small, is sort of a subdominant effect. And that's, I want you to remember it, because things are going to look, in that respect, are going to look a little bit different later on. One last little point is that you got to be sure to find the minimum entropy point along the way. If you imagine this thing undergoing a trajectory, something like this, if you accidentally choose the entropy of this point to define your probabilities, you'll get a higher probability because you'll be including actually lots of trajectories that go here but then don't go on to there but instead go right back to equilibrium. So you've got to make sure to work in this way that you're choosing the minimum entropy point along the way. So some general comments. By assuming ergodicity and by choosing a specific physical system, there's a concrete framework for calculating recurrence times and probabilities. And this was used by Dyson et al. To quantify the competition between different paths to the observed universe. And I just want to make a quick comment. Fischler and Banks have a very interesting objection to this scheme, where they point out that basically quantum measurements fail on a time shorter than the recurrence time of the whole system. But I'm not going to worry about that. I think it's a very interesting point, but you don't have to take that point of view. You can think of this just like, in fact, part of this point is that this is definitely not thermodynamics we're doing, it's stat-mech. The entropy goes up, goes down just as often as it goes up, because we're looking at a system beyond the thermodynamic scope of its behavior. And so, yeah. I'm sorry. Oh dear. You could raise the same objection should you, since we know thermodynamics is a quality of the world that we like, and the second law in particular, is the system poorly defined in the limit beyond which thermodynamics applies? And I kind of like the idea that you in fact can talk very sensibly about a system outside of that limit. There's a you can look at it from a microscopic point of view, and it's well defined, even in the regime where thermodynamics is not. So I tend to hope that somehow we can think of quantum mechanics in a way that transcends the point, that transcends the duration over which quantum measurements make sense. But I think it's a very interesting point. I'm basically just deciding not to worry about it for this talk. So, having reviewed the sort of conceptual starting point, I'd like to just remind you in this context what inflation is supposed to do. So, the standard Big Bang is a huge amount of matter in a very low entropy state. You might not be used to thinking about it that way, but Penrose taught us how to see it that way. It could be a giant black hole. It's not. It's much lower entropy in the gravitational sense than it might be. And so, and you can think of the traditional cosmological problems as connected with that. It's not the usual way of presenting it, but it's possible to think about it that way. And so if you imagine some random chaotic starting point for the universe, fluctuating into the standard Big Bang out of that chaos seems outrageously unlikely because it's so much lower entropy. And so the deal with inflation, roughly speaking, seemed to be that inflation was cheap. It was a tiny little easily acquired fluctuation that would start inflation, and then there'd be attractor behavior and large volume production that would generate huge regions like the ones we observe. And just sort of looking at it, it seemed obvious that it was much more easy to produce the universe we see that way, starting with a really cheap fluctuation, than by expecting the standard Big Bang itself in all its glory to fluctuate out of some kind of chaos. And so that's sort of what we're hoping, the story we're hoping to tell with inflation. And now I'd like to talk about how that failed in the specific calculations of Dyson et al. So the starting point is to consider equilibrium, and it's sketched here in this more or less useless cartoon, but basically there's an area that goes with the horizon. And then I want to think about a small perturbation to that. And if it's a small perturbation, small localized perturbation, then far away from that perturbation, the space-time is going to look Schwarzschild. And we know all the way back from Gibbons and Hawking what a black hole in a de Sitter space looks like. And the area is modified by this geometric mean of the two horizon areas.
So, Andy, don't the constraint parts of Einstein's equation prohibit fluctuations to things with different ADM masses?
Well, these are quantum fluctuations, so I don't think there's a problem with that.
Well, I would have thought the constraints may act on the wave function, so
it doesn't. Well, I don't think that's a problem. The question was, do the constraint equations prevent this kind of fluctuation? And I don't think that's a problem. Anyway, let's leave that for the discussion, because it's part of this framework, and that's maybe something worth pursuing in the discussion, clarifying it a bit more. So far this looks good, looks like just what we want, because presumably a random fluctuation of the whole Big Bang out of de Sitter equilibrium would look like a black hole with entire mass of the universe from the outside. And surely the fluctuation required for inflation is cheaper, just some little region, just maybe a couple of Hubble volumes of the inflationary Hubble length to get the inflation started. So so far it's looking very nice. But that's not the calculation that Dyson et al. Actually ended up doing, because horizon forms for the inflating region, and at that point holographic magic is evoked, and in particular the picture that's used is that once you start inflating, you effectively have a much smaller horizon, and then the expression of the holographic way of thinking that is used in this line of reasoning says that once you have the horizon, all the degrees of freedom have to organize themselves to tell you only about what's inside that horizon. And that's some incredibly non-local thing. No one's specified in detail how that works, but this is the holographic way of thinking that's used in this kind of analysis, and it's not the first time. It's a very standard way of trying to think about horizons and think about causal patch physics in this kind of system. And but then the entropy of this inflating region is tiny by comparison. It's on a completely different scale than the entropy of the large the sitter space that's sort of forming the equilibrium, the background here. And so most of the degrees of freedom must actually condense out. And
you end up with a very low entropy state to work with.
And this is where the trouble starts, as you see. I'm even having trouble with the mic. So this is where we run into trouble. And this is, right now I'm just reporting. So one of the things, of course, we want to know is this the right way to think about it? But for right now, I'm just reporting how these guys analyzed it. So let me spell this out. So this now is not what actually happens. This is what we sort of would have hoped to get. So we want to compare the probability to create the universe via inflation versus the probability of what I call a random Big Bang. So the Big Bang sort of emerging out of as a fluctuation without inflation, just randomly in some other way. And so the way we'd evaluate this is we have, of course, the total entropy out here forming a normalization, which cancels out. And then we have the entropy for the fluctuation that starts inflation versus entropy for the random Big Bang. And we express those here as some kind of Schwarzschild-like perturbation on the sitter space-time in each of these cases. And that's what survives impacting the result. And the hope, of course, is that the Schwarzschild, the external Schwarzschild appearance of the fluctuation that starts inflation represents a much smaller entropy than the case of the Big Bang. And so when that all plays out, inflation is highly favored over the other, because basically you're stealing away less entropy from the bath to start inflation than to create the standard Big Bang. So this is what we were hoping. This is sort of the intuition that comes with, you know, spending 20 years thinking about inflation. It's got to be something like this that goes on. But instead, what they found was, yeah, you have this initial inflationary fluctuation, but then through this causal patch magic, it works itself into a state where it's just the entropy of this quasi-de Sitter space that's inflating, which takes on some tiny value compared to the entropy of the whole. So this can be like 10 to the 10th or something, compared with 10 to the 120. And so we've really got, we've discovered by doing this analysis that inflation is way more costly. Coming to the standard Big Bang via inflation is a great deal more costly than coming there via some random fluctuation. So it's just the opposite of what we had hoped. Yeah.
Does this problem get worse or better if you think about a time
limit first? I'm getting there step by step. I don't know if I'll exactly answer that, but I can take smaller steps and we can maybe bring that up a little later. So now I've just replaced, so the slide from a couple slides ago, I've now sort of inserted what you actually get from this calculation, and here we are with a with this annoying small entropy for inflation showing up, which shows specifically that inflation is highly disfavored. Now you could say, well, okay, so we're seeing inflation sort of lose out in terms of the cheapness of the initial fluctuation. But can you make up for it by having exponentially large volume factors? So you maybe could enhance the probability that a region like ours came about via inflation by actually producing a lot more regions like ours as inflation plays itself out. And so I'm now considering a volume enhancement. So n is the number of regions the size of the observable universe that you produce via inflation, and I'm proposing to enhance the probability assigned to inflation by that factor. Every now and then people get confused about whether that's the right thing to do with these volume factors. I'm convinced it is, and I'd rather talk offline about that if someone's worried, because I'm not going to include that in this particular talk. So I'm proposing this kind of enhancement, but you've got to be careful. It's not that simple, because there's an upper bound. If you have this fundamental de Sitter space as your heat bath, there's an upper bound to the amount of volume you can have. So there's an upper bound on this maximum, and it's some power, inverse power of lambda, depending on exactly how you think about it. But the point here is that it's just a power, just an inverse power, whereas the total entropy, basically it's interrelated. The amount of volume you can have is interrelated with the value of lambda, which also figures in as the entropy of the whole system. And what you find is that it actually works against you. So releasing the upper bound on the number of the size of the volume you can create altogether by decreasing lambda makes this issue worse, because by decreasing lambda you're increasing the entropy of the entire bath. And remember, the whole issue with inflation is that somehow the entropy of the entire bath gets frozen out and leaves you just this tiny little inflating entropy. And so if you make the bath bigger, it costs you more to get rid of all that entropy and create a little inflating region. So that's how so at least in this naive kind of argument, you don't win by trying to win your way back with volume factors.
The bound on number of defaults is also holographic in nature.
This is just blindly saying how much if the heat bath is this de Sitter space, how much volume could I fit in to it?
But it doesn't have to fit that way. You could sort of
So that's an interesting alternative view, which I'm actually going to come back to as well. And actually, Willie and Tom have some very interesting discussion of this in another paper. So we definitely have to come back to that. But so this is right now a sort of simple-minded analysis. And actually, just a very brief comment that not only does inflation fail in this picture, but actually so does the standard Big Bang. It turns out it doesn't. There's many other ways to get more or less to the universe we observe rather than the whole story of the standard Big Bang. And it's actually, I'm not going to dwell on this because I don't think it's actually very surprising. This is a new version of what I like to call Boltzmann's brain, which is basically something that Boltzmann worried about, which is that if you look at the cheapest fluctuation that's consistent with everything you know, it's really just your brain fluctuating out of chaos and then fluctuating back in. Because the whole, you know, this beautiful empty, or nearly empty universe, very low entropy universe, is really overkill in terms of being a rare fluctuation compared with what we know about it. And so this is not surprising. Inflation, as I've emphasized in a paper from a couple years ago, inflation had a hope of resolving this, but in general, this could be a problem. I think inflation is the first hope of actually addressing this issue, although it's not something people tend to worry too much about. But anyway, this is a sketch of the problems encountered in the Dyson et al. Paper. Right. So now, how general are these failures? And of course, the thing you'd want to jump on is actually the second item on my list. Do we really believe that the entropy of inflation is given by this tiny value, which is much less than the total entropy? And I think that's definitely a this thing we want to focus on. But there's actually something else I want to start with, which is an interesting point, is that the entropy is decreasing here, which you might think is weird. So we have this, we start inflation with some small fluctuation in this De Sitter heat bath. It gets this Schwarzschild perturbation. It's a small perturbation. It's a pretty high entropy state. And then through some dynamics, the system gets sucked into a state with very tiny entropy. So the entropy is decreasing by a massive degree. And you can wonder, well, what's going on? It's one thing to say, well, the rare fluctuations can produce decreases in the entropy, but this is dynamically an attractor. This is supposedly what the universe really wants to do. It's not just a rare fluctuation. It's going from this initial perturbation to the properly inflating state is supposed to be dynamically favored. So what's going on? So I want to comment briefly that one thing that could be going on is we might just be getting a little bit confused about coarse graining and the various ingredients that go into defining entropy and figuring out whether it is increasing or not. And so here's a really, really simple example where there's an attractor behavior. So this is actually an upside-down harmonic oscillator. This is motion in the phase space, the well-known squeezing behavior. So your little blob in the phase space of an upside-down harmonic oscillator gets squeezed up against this diagonal line as time goes on. And if you think about a coarse graining, which is defined by this grid on the phase space, then the entropy clearly increases as the system evolves, because you start maybe in sort of forward grid points, and then as time goes on, you just get squeezed out, and you have a divergent, you occupy a divergent number of these little boxes, which under this coarse graining scheme would lead to an increase of entropy. But here's another coarse graining scheme. You could put the bins like this, and in that coarse graining scheme, you actually find that the entropy decreases because the entire region gets smushed into one bin as time goes on. And this is actually not a completely manipulative kind of picture to draw, because in fact, this is, if you think about attractor behavior, what you think when you think of an attractor is of information being forgotten, information being lost. So you have a bunch of initial conditions. There's an attractor kind of dynamics which takes all these different initial conditions to the same state. And if you want to describe that process, what you have to do is think with this kind of coarse graining. Because if it's a Hamiltonian system, it's never, there's always conservation of phase space. And so that kind of statement that attractor behaviors sort of attract you into one kind of state is only possible with when you're doing some kind of coarse graining. And so this is maybe a useful way to describe it, but it's certainly not ergodic. You can't, the entropy decreases, you can't sort of use this kind of coarse graining to assume an ergodic kind of analysis. And so this is just basically a warning that you got to be careful. You know, entropy is just your servant. It's, you know, the real dynamics is given by whatever microscopic of physics you assume, and entropy can do all kinds of weird things depending on exactly how you define it. So perhaps this decreasing entropy is nothing more than an artifact of a particular coarse graining scheme, and maybe we think harder about it, we will discover, it might actually be very valuable. I shouldn't say nothing more than an artifact. It may actually lead to insights. This is the sort of thin end of the wedge in terms of understanding better. Maybe we don't want to be using this entropy to estimate probabilities, for example. So it's an interesting kind of issue that deserves further thought. Yeah.
So could you just go back to slides of the decreasing entropy? One more.
So that this is decreasing entropy, and that's increasing.
No, I'm sorry. The one before that where you have the equation. Yeah, this one. So this one here on the left is the entropy of the De Sitter space when you have a mass of, that is equivalent to the mass of the
little fluctuation.
Okay.
Whereas the one that is so much smaller is just the entropy of the horizon during inflation?
Yes, exactly.
Then isn't the discrepancy explained by the fact that there are a lot of things other than inflation that have the same mass? For example, not just the black hole that's made out of other stuff, but also lots of larger matter systems that reach out to the horizon, fill this inner space, and have the same total mass, so decrease the area.
I think I'm getting to part of that question next, but we'll see. Right. So I'm almost to that part of it. Oh no, here I am. So perhaps, right, so perhaps we just need to think better about what entropy we're using here. But there's also another interesting issue that came up in discussion at a meeting a couple months ago on this subject, which is that these authors have, many of whom are here, have carefully studied the issue of if you try to assemble an inflating region classically, you actually can't do it. And there's actually, you have to undergo quantum tunneling for some region that you're actually physically assembling classically to begin inflating. And so somewhere in that conversation, although I don't think any of the participants want their name attached to it, it was conjectured that the tunneling rate might magically sort of cooperate with this holography and introduce the right suppression factor so that when you include this quantum tunneling effect, the entropy isn't really going down. And I think that's related to what Raphael was asking, although I'm not completely sure. But anyway, the idea is that only of all these little fluctuations that are so cheap, maybe only some of them are actually inflating. And then that would lead to the conjecture basically that you can only tunnel at some exponentially suppressed rate from a state with this kind of entropy to actual inflation, and that the tunneling may sort of do the bookkeeping for you, and that's sort of an intriguing issue. But I think that's a danger, because if that's really true, if somehow magically these tunneling rates always make inflation so hard to start that it's just as if it was, that it sort of represents this time, the effect of this tiny entropy, then it sort of could drag inflation down with it, in the sense that the problem is that this calculation is telling us that inflation is really hard to start. And if that difficulty is expressed not only through weird causal patch stuff that nobody quite believes, but instead is expressed through some much more concrete tunneling rate that has nothing to do with crazy assumptions about quantum gravity, then maybe, or not as much to do with it or something, maybe that could be even seen as a bit of more of a threat. So I think we shouldn't, I mean, it's a very interesting question. The upshot is we don't quite know if it's a problem. We need to think harder about the coarse graining, but there's also this issue of the tunneling, which I think is very interesting. So I just have a couple of minutes left. The other question, obviously, and really a theme, I think, of this talk, is that we really want to think about this. Do we really believe that the inflating state has such a tiny entropy? And Banks and Fischler and, let's see, this is the one I left someone off of. This is your number of e-foldings, calculation. This is the two of you simply say no, and they have another account for how to think holographically about inflating region, and they say, well, it's not this small, it's larger, so I think, but this adds weight to that issue, because this is sort of the fate of our whole understanding of cosmology lies with understanding this properly. And again, a yes answer will impact beyond the sort of de Sitter space business, because this is saying really any fluctuation that starts inflation would be more expensive than we might have thought, whether or not it's fluctuating out of the de Sitter space. Pneumonia Caliper, Yongsan Song, and I have made another account of entropy, basically applying holographic theory during inflation. We've chosen a specific light sheet, holographic screen, and come up with another estimation where it seems like we're under a little bit more pressure than the analysis of Banks and Fischler. I can't get into the nitty-gritty of this in the time remaining, but I'll just say that Nemanja and I make a point of being very conservative about this in the sense that all we really know that this bounds is the limits of the sort of effective field theory analysis that we're using. But I think it's interesting. It is interrelated. It's something that we is a very, very important issue. So just a comment as I wrap up. Many of the issues seem to generalize beyond the whole business of fluctuating out of de Sitter equilibrium. Specifically, we're talking about a way of thinking that cuts into the supposed competitive advantage of a cheap initial fluctuation, and that there may be other theories of compete where these fluctuations compete not based on a sort of de Sitter heat bath, but they may have some similar problems. I think it's very very interesting to be working on these things. So I'm wrapping up now. So a list of concrete questions. These are interesting questions specifically because the answers to them could really change how we think about cosmology. The question about the tunneling rates. Does this conjecture about the suppression due to quantum tunneling about starting inflation, does that pan out? What do horizons say about the entropy of the entire universe during inflation? What limits do fundamental physics place on the volume of the reheated regions? It's nice if they're infinite, as Alan has emphasized a great deal. This eternal, if it could be eternal, that's really a powerful weighting factor to put in, but do we really have that weighting factor? And are there other specific frameworks where we can do these calculations as opposed to the Sitter equilibrium? I think the no boundary proposal is the way Stephen's been presenting the no boundary proposal recently, which sounds different, and I don't know if he's thinking any differently, but it sounds different than when I first heard it many years ago. It seems very similar in the sense that it's trying to express random fluctuation. What's the most random, assuming nothing about how you start, what's the most likely path to what we see? And so the relationship to that, I think, is a very interesting issue. And basically, if you really believe all the assumptions of Dyson et al., I think the honest conclusion is that you don't believe there is a fundamental positive cosmological constant, actually. Because if you really believe all the arguments, you then make predictions for the universe that say it wouldn't look like it underwent inflation, it wouldn't look like it underwent a Big Bang. You're actually making predictions that are ruled out by data. So I think that line of reasoning is quite interesting and worth discussing further. So to wrap up, I find this exciting because these issues of quantifying what inflation does and how it competes with other paths to produce what we see is, I think it's very exciting to think that we may be reaching a new level of quantitativeness in doing that. And it seems to raise very specific questions, some of which seem actually tractable and could have a really exciting deep impact on how we think about cosmology. So I hope I get to talk with people who are here about some of these questions this week. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. We have time for a couple questions.
I just want to say, I think there's not such a big mystery about the apparent decrease in entropy, because we have to keep in mind that a black hole is only the maximal entropy state if you specify the area. But if you specify the mass, then you get a lot more phase space by allowing large wavelength modes that have much larger wavelength than the black hole. Now, in the one case, the small entropy you calculated was the entropy of the inflating patch, which is about the same entropy as a small black hole that has the same radius and is sitting inside the big de Sitter space. Mm-hmm. That is much smaller than the other entropy which you calculated, which is basically the area difference in the cosmological horizon when right. you insert that kind of mass into right. the big de Sitter space. And the reason why the second one is so much larger is that most of those states don't come from the little black hole that's sitting in the center. Most of those states come right. from modes that are spread over the entire right. de Sitter space. And I think that sort of captures the main problem that you're coming across and one of the assumptions that are crucial to it, which is that you have to start with something large, and then you get into trouble when you try to get inflation to start with a small effective mm-hmm. de Sitter mm-hmm. radius. Mm-hmm. And of course, the assumption that goes into this is this, it's not just that you have a fundamental cosmological constant, but that there's a unitary quantum gravity theory with a finite number of degrees of freedom that describes that. And I think a lot of people would be more readily willing to give that up than to say, you know, you can't have an...
Yeah, I think that's an interesting perspective, and that's exactly... I think the nice thing about all this is it lays it out on the line that there's a lot at stake in terms of how you... what choices you make. In that way, and I think that's a good, right. I was really, when I sat down and sort of thought this through carefully, I was really alarmed at the idea that somehow you really think you're trading in, you have all this entropy out there, and somehow you magically claim you're going to trade it all in for tiny entropy. But that is the nature of these. I mean, I think people have found appeal in that when they think about black hole information and all that. There's some appeal in positing these magical transformations, but it is pretty dramatic.
I think I'd like to give an answer, which I don't think you did, to the question of how specific these problems were to the assumptions that were made in that paper. And it seems to me that they were rather specific to those assumptions, namely that there was a very special assumption being made about the initial conditions as being typical fluctuations given by the thermal weight of the de Sitter Hamiltonian rather than something else. Mm-hmm. I think it didn't depend just on the fact that you were thinking about a system that had a finite number of degrees of freedom, not thinking that you had a fixed Hamiltonian for that system, there was a recurrence time, and you were just thinking about all the different recurrences and what was the typical recurrence that would lead to something that looked somewhat like our universe. And I think that was a very attractive attempt. If it had worked, it would have been a very nice idea, but I think it failed, and that doesn't say anything about anything except that particular idea. I think it really depends very much on assuming that you have to pay attention to the recurrences defined by this particular Hamiltonian.
Right. So maybe another way of saying it is this system ergodic relative to the entropy that's defined in this way? And maybe it's not. But then do you have an idea where, you know, is it ergodic in any sense? Do you have an alternative? I mean, it would be nice. I mean, it's sorry. You know, you have a completely different alternative, but so you're, like, the holographic cosmology is a very different approach to all these issues. Do you think it's fundamentally flawed to even hope for this kind of, I mean, it's one thing to say, well, look, they made very specific assumptions about what's ergodic and how to estimate probabilities and all that, and they have, and maybe it's wrong. But it could be wrong in the way where you say, well, actually, here's the right way. Yeah, you can do all that stuff. You just got to get it right. Here's the right way, and then everything works out. But I'm curious what you think. Is there probably a right way, or do you think there's a real deep flaw in trying to think this way about fluctuations? And
yeah, I think the two things that are wrong here are assuming that the consider Hamiltonian, which may be a good description of the far future of the universe, is the description of the remote past of the universe. And second, paying attention to these large recurrence times, which are larger than anything you can ever measure.
So you're saying serves you right. So this quantum. So instead of instead of brushing off this quantum measurement thing, you're saying that was a hint that you were getting into trouble.
Okay. Last question. Okay, perhaps a comment. Now, can he lift up?
Yes, sir.
The universe would not fit here. I mean, it's not one small causal patch. I just want to say that there are several different points of view of how the universe emerged, and the point of view which was expressed by Lenny, I do not even know whether Lenny still continues believing that this particular point of view works. But let me just explain what is the point of view and what I believe is the standard point of view. Okay, by standard, let me just start with old inflation. Forget about all problems of this theory. So you have like De Sitter space with large cosmological constant. And then in the small De Sitter space, there are some bubbles formed which put us to the better world with a small energy density. And this world which we live now is supposed to have a very, very small cosmological constant. Okay? So the process, however, goes this way. This phase transition happens once, but it happens in this point. It does not happen here. The distance between these two bubbles continue growing exponentially, so the total volume of the whole universe continues growing exponentially. We, however, already sitting here, our life formed, and we look around and we see 10 to the 28 centimeters around us, and we think we are bounded by that for all of our life because it's our present cosmological constant, if there is really a cosmological constant, which we do not know yet. Okay? So then, what Lenny and others studied was the following. Well, let us wait here for the amount of years, which is like 10 to the 120, which is e to the entropy of the universe. And then everything is dead already there. What is the probability that the new observers will resurrect from the dead? Okay? So that was the question, and that was exactly the question which was studied right now. Because the standard situation is this way. We are created after tunneling here, and then there is a short period of life, maybe short, maybe a little bit longish, but probably not this, because all baryons will decay during this time. So it is still possible that from vacuum...
But Andre, you don't have a concrete quantitative way of treating this.
So some people think that De Sitter space is just this. I mean, this part doesn't exist. Of course, those people who try to construct like a geodesically complete manifold, they know that De Sitter space is a little bit larger than that. They zoom only at the part which is observable. Of course, it is observable by nobody when everybody here is dead. So where the new observers come? Well, the new observers come from here because there is new space which is all the time produced. And then these new observers will be surrounded by this 10 to the 28 centimeters volume, and they will see new parts of this infinite De Sitter space. So if you consider all observers, including those which are created just because of exponential expansion of the universe, what will be the total rate of creation of new observers? Well, it will be proportional to the total rate of growth of the volume, which can be Planckian. So that is the speed of the total amount of observers created in the whole universe. Meanwhile, in the dead universe, you will have exponentially some small chance that some observers will be created and they will be surprised because they will not see this delta rho, rho equal to 10 minus 5 with a flat spectrum. So I do not think that it is surprising because most of the observers are those who are still in the process of being created in this eternal inflating universe.
Thank you. Okay, I think it's time to call the session to an end. And thank Andy Abakian.